We'll begin this evening talking about early child training. And I agree with Brad that child training is one of the more important things that we can talk about. Because there is the training we need for ourselves, and that's vital. But child training affects the next generation. And it makes such a difference in their lives, and not just in their lives, but in their children's lives, in the lives that they will affect. And so just when we're blessed with children, and it's good to see the babies here and toddlers here and young people here, that's a great blessing, and it's a big responsibility. And so to spend time thinking about that and talking about that is a great thing, and I appreciate the opportunity to be with you and talk about it. As Brad mentioned, my wife and I were blessed with six kids, three boys, three girls. But I remember the first time that I was ever asked to go speak on the family and child raising, I was still single. So I rode over on my motorcycle, and I got up, and I talked about marriage, even though I wasn't married, and I talked about child raising, even though I had never had any children. But you know what? The stuff in here is in here whether you've already done that or not. And married people get married and start doing marriage when the week before they'd not ever been married. And when you have that first baby, you start being a parent even though you've never been a parent before. And for the young people here who aren't married yet, if you will go into it with a love for God and a love for your children and wanting to work and spend the time to help them be what you want them to be, not what the world wants them to be, you can do a great job of it. It's not that there aren't challenges and there aren't difficulties, but if you will listen to the book of Proverbs and other scriptures, and along with advice from older brethren, parents, grandparents, and different things. But you, when you have your first children, if you will decide what you want for your child and say, I want them to be well-behaved. I want them to tell the truth. I want them to be obedient. I want them to be respectful. You can get that. And we encourage you in that. Early child training. The book of Proverbs says, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. That doesn't take away the free will of the child. A lot of things in the book of Proverbs are truisms. This is the way life works. This is what is generally so. It doesn't mean in some cases that there can't be an exception to that. A good way to illustrate it is Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1. What turns away wrath? A soft answer. Generally speaking, does a soft answer help turn away wrath? Yes. Are there ever occasions where you give a soft answer and the person is going to be wrathful anyway? Yes, that may happen occasionally, but as a general rule, it's a soft answer that turns away wrath. Grievous words stir up anger. And as a truism, as a general rule, if you train up a child in the way he should go, even when he is old, he will not depart from it. You largely get what you expect. If you expect tantrums, you'll get them. If you expect dishonesty, you will get it. If you expect bad attitudes, you will get it. If you really expect the opposite and require and train for the opposite, you can get the opposite. But you have to actually expect it. Now, to illustrate that, let's consider what, I'm not sure how they do Marine camp, boot camp training now, but if you remember how the stereotypical training used to go, imagine a bus is pulled off and a bunch of raw recruits are getting off that bus. And here's the Marine sergeant, the drill sergeant, that's going to turn them into Marines. does he expect that they are going to march like they're supposed to, do push-ups like they're supposed to, make a bed like they're supposed to, and everything else? Does he expect that? Yes, he does. Does that mean he thinks they're already there? No. But he expects they will get there, and so by the time they're done with their training, guess where they're at? That's where they're at because that is what he expects, and he doesn't tolerate less than that. Now, if he thinks, oh, well, I don't think they can do that very good. Oh, they don't seem to be good at that. I don't think they can do that. If he starts changing his expectations, then it's what's going to happen. The training's not going to happen. So it's about expectations. Proverbs 29, verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. And if you've spent enough time at Walmart, you've seen that a few times. Parents. The text said, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Some years ago, Judith Harris wrote a book called Do Parents Really Matter? And it was on the nature-nurture debate. Would everybody here suppose that to a certain extent we are who we are because of our DNA and our genetics? And that genetically we might be better at some things than other things? Would everybody here agree that who our parents are and how we're trained makes a big difference in our lives? Well, according to Judith Harris, that didn't make much difference. So she wrote a book, and it was reviewed, I don't remember if it was Time or Newsweek, and the science editor, fortunately, was not impressed with her book, and you could tell by the review or the article on it that they weren't very impressed. But there's people that think this way, and she published this book, I suppose an important book at the time, and she said, for example, that your children are going to be what they are going to be due to two things, their genes and their peer group. And that's it. They said, you as a parent don't make a difference. And so the basic answer to her question was she thought no. Now, there were some things you could do, so she illustrated it like this. Since your children are going to be controlled by their genetics, and you can't change that, and their peer group, you can change that. So she said, as a parent, you know what your job is? Make enough money to live in the best school district so they'll be with the best peers. And because appearance matters, make enough money to dress them in the latest style so that they'll fit in with the best peers. And make enough money to, if they need braces or plastic surgery, to do that. And that was in a serious advice in this book. And I got to thinking about it. And I'm afraid that in some families, genetics and peers are the main influence in children. When would that happen? That can happen when parents abdicate the role of training their children. If you don't train your children, if you're constantly turning them to, if as a baby, you turn it over to daycare. And then they're in school, and then you send them somewhere away for the summer, and they're home alone, and you spend just minimal amount of time with the child, then that child, guess who is going to influence that child? Their peers in the media and the culture. But that's when parents aren't doing their job. Parents need to do their job. And it does make a difference. Time issues. We talked yesterday, I think we mentioned gardens. Let's bring that up again. If you're about to put in a garden here in the spring, you're going to sow the seed, put in some little plants. And if all you do is sow the seed and you don't care for it, you don't tend for it, you don't protect it, and you don't weed it, what are you going to get come harvest time? You're going to have a terrible crop. But what do you do if you really care about that garden? You put time into that garden. And if there's some rabbits coming, they're going to be, you put up a fence to keep them out. And if there's not enough water, you're watering. If they need some fertilizer, you're fertilizing. If some weeds get in there, you pull them out. And then what do you have at harvest time? You have a nice crop. And then imagine if your neighbor looks over the fence and they've got a bunch of weeds and scrawny little tomatoes and stuff and say, oh, you're so lucky. Your vegetables were so easy. You ever heard that people say that to you about your kids? They'll say, you're lucky. You just had easy children. If you've got good children, you put time into those children. You've worked with those children. You've loved those children. You've disciplined those children. You've trained those children. Now, there, if you've got several children, you know that some children are easier than others, but they all need work. And we'll talk more about some of those differences later. Here's another way to think about it, and that is that this spring, a bird is going to come along, and it's going to build a nest in a tree in your yard, which, by the way, just from an evidence standpoint, it's just remarkable just to stop and consider nest building that birds do. You try building a nest without any hands. You know, he does it with his beak and his feet and everything, and some of them tuck it under their wings. It's going to build a nest. They're going to lay those eggs. And by the time that bird hatches, how long will it be before that bird goes away and never needs its mother again? Very short. It's going to come out of that egg. It's going to sit there asking for a worm. It's going to fly away. And it will very soon never need its mother again. Cats. A little bit longer, but the same thing. Most kittens never knew who the father was. They're not going to need their mother very long. And within weeks, they can be on their own. That doesn't work with humans, does it? If you've got a one-year-old baby here this evening, that was a cat, or that was a bird, they'd be off and on their own by now. Is your one-year-old ready to be off on their own? No. How about after 2 years? Well, after 3 years, surely a human being would be able to be on something. No. God's given us a lot of time with our children, and we need to use that time to an advantage. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 7. You shall teach them. Let's start with verse 6. These are the words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. To teach our children. Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 4, a passage we read yesterday about fathers. Ephesians 6, verse 4. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Nurture them in the chastening and admonition of the Lord. And it's important to start early. Early child training is really important. There's some things a baby doesn't understand and a little one doesn't understand. But in simple ways, we can start training our children early. And one of the important things in early child training, after they get old enough to understand it, is the word no. It's one of the earliest words that a baby learns. A baby learns mama, a baby learns daddy, a baby learns no. These are three important words to begin with. And that baby needs to learn that when baby is told no, it means no. It's really, really vital. I'll tell you, when I was a teenager, there was a lot of things I didn't know. There's a lot of things I don't know now. But I would see kids, and you've seen this type of thing, you know, their parents would say something, and they'd say, no. And I decided, I'm never going to have a kid. It goes, no. And after six kids, we never did. Now, I didn't say we never had a child ever say no. Maybe one time. But if they did, they learned right then that that was not what they were going to be able to do. So it wasn't what they did. Most of them didn't even do it once. But if they did it, they learned you don't do that. No. A child can learn no before they know why the thing is no. Consider, for example, the importance of no in going back to some things early in the Bible. Genesis chapter 2. What's the rule here in Genesis? What rule is man given? Genesis chapter 2, verse 17. After verse 16 saying, the Lord God commanded the man, saying, you may surely eat of every tree of the garden. But if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. So God gave man a rule, and what was that rule? No. Then what does Eve do? This tempter tempts her. She looks at it. It looks good. It looks like it would be good. It appeals to her ego, and she goes for it. How mature was Eve when she did that? If you've just recently been created, and I don't know how quickly it is from the moment of her creation to the time that the fruit is eaten, but I would understand the situation that Adam was made in the shape of a full-grown man and that Eve would have been made in the shape of a full-grown woman. Wouldn't that be what you would assume? But how much experience did they have? How much wisdom did they have? They wouldn't have had a lot of wisdom and experience, would they? And what kind of rule did God start them out with? A no-no. No, no. Do not eat this. And they did. And were there consequences? Yes, there were. They're cast out of the garden. And the curses were replaced. You think of in Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, I've heard people, I remember a Seventh-day Adventist fellow saying that the Ten Commandments were the highest commandments in the whole Bible. Well, I know that's not true because Jesus was asked what was the greatest commandment, and he didn't quote any of the ten. He quoted what? From Deuteronomy 6, where we read just a moment ago earlier, where it said the Lord, it talked about love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. That, he said, was the greatest commandment. And the second greatest commandment was from Leviticus, love your neighbor as yourself. Why are those greater than the Ten Commandments? Well, for one thing, they cover more, and they're positive instead of negative. You see, you can follow the Ten Commandments and not do these ten things and still be a bad person. The priest and the Levite in the parable of the Good Samaritan, did they create a graven image? When they walked by the man laying there half dead, were they worshiping idols? No. Taking the Lord's name in vain? No. Did they steal from that beaten, half-dead man? No. Did they take his wife? No. Did they kill him? No. Did they cover this up? No. But they didn't what? Love their neighbor as themselves. So the Ten Commandments are important laws, but they're not the very highest. But they are important. And it was given to the Israelites when they're coming out of Egypt. Now, the people coming out of Egypt, how would you rate them on maturity? Would you say those are some of the most mature people in biblical history or some of the more immature people in biblical history? Just think about it for a minute. These are the people that when they get to the desert, oh, we wish you, they're crying for deliverance. They get deliverance and they say, oh, you should have let us die in Egypt. Then they get across the water and they start complaining we don't have water. They're given water, complain we don't have food. They're given food, they're complaining that they're tired of manna. You know, and they're always looking right here instead of ahead, right? And they're starting to remember, oh, we remember how good we had it in Egypt. So I'm going to ask the question again. Was this a mature group of people? No. And you know what a lot of the Ten Commandments are? A list of no-nos. Now, Romans 13 says what? It says, if you will love your neighbor as yourself, that takes care of all these other commandments. Don't kill. Don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness. That's all going to be covered if you love your neighbor as yourself. But I want you to suppose that one of you is going to be in charge of not only all the toddlers here, but like a whole bunch of toddlers. So 30 toddlers, and you're going to take care of them while the rest of us go all do something. And so the mom say, now listen, you know, if he needs discipline him, you go ahead and discipline him, or if he needs a spanking, give him a spanking, and they... And the person says, oh, no, we're not going to have any disciplinary problems. Really? We're going to be gone a few hours. We won't have any trouble because I'm going to explain to these children that we're all going to respect each other. Okay, good luck with that because you know what? If you've got 30 toddlers that you're going to take care of for a few hours and you start off with, now, we're not going to have any problems because we're just going to love and respect. It's not going to be long before you're going to have to get into the no-nos. You know, no kicking, no biting, no, no, because they're not going to catch the more noble, higher things. But you know what they can understand? No. If you were told no kicking and you kicked, you're going to be punished. If you were told no hair pulling and you're hair pulling, you're going to be punished. A little child can understand no. They don't have to understand why, but they need to understand no. My oldest girl, April, her first spanking, she was a little baby, and she was in the bathroom, and she was just taking the toilet paper and going to town, you know, pulling it off of there. And Bertina said, no, no. And Bertina took her little hand, no, no. And, of course, it broke her little heart. You know, she, rah! But she stopped pulling on the toilet paper. She understood there was a connection when mom said no. If she ignored that, there was a connection and she got punished. She put two and two together. Babies, young children can understand that. It's really valuable. So with our children, there has to be a respect and compliance with the prohibitory no. When mom says no, it's no. And none of this business, mom says no. But daddy, can I do it? You know, sometimes children try to play one against the other. No needs to mean no. But then the little child learns something else. What do they learn? They learn that no is a really powerful word, don't they? So then they decide to employ it themselves. The problem is, now it is a defiant no. Because when no is coming from mom, that's not defiance, that's guidance and instruction, and he needs to obey that. But now he decides to employ this word and say, no. If it happens, let him understand it is to never happen again. You don't get to do that. You don't tell mom, no. You don't tell dad, no. Now, you can answer questions with a no. You know, would you like another piece of cake? No, thank you. That's fine. You know, do you know where this is? No, that's fine. But you know what we're talking about here, that defiant no. Don't tolerate that defiant and rebellious no. And let me say one more thing before I go to the next point. I believe that if a person really concentrates on this and gets this established well, you've got a whole lot of your job as parenting already accomplished. As they grow up, things will get more complicated. You'll have other challenges. But if when they were little, they learned, mom said, no, I can't do that. And I won't do that. And they've learned, I am not going to tell my parents no. You've already created the heart in there that needs to be there. You've created the for what things need to be. And as time goes by, you'll need to adjust to new challenges and teach them new things, but the right framework is already there. But if you don't do that, if you let that child grow up with the attitude that when you say no, it can be argued against, it can be ignored, it can be, let me go ahead and go this, I'll tell you a story about this. I lived in a dry county, and that's not really relevant to the story, though. But where we were going to go, because, of course, we weren't going for liquor or anything, but we were going to go to another town, Huntsville. And a friend of mine's mother told him, no, you're not going to Huntsville. I don't remember what we were going to go over there for, look at a car or whatever. But it was amazing to watch the conversation. She immediately said, no. And he began to complain. No. He complained. No. He countered. No. He kept countering. You know, you need to mow the grass. I can mow the grass tomorrow. I already mowed part. And then eventually it got to where she caved in and she said, well, how long will you be gone? One day he said to me, he said, the only reason I don't slap my mother is because I know what would happen when my dad got home. That's sad. Now, he's got a much better attitude toward his mother after he got grown up and everything. But as a boy, do you see what his attitude was? He found her annoying. Her immediate answer would be like, no, no, no. But if he just kept chiseling at it, what happened? It turned into a yes. Did that make him love his mother? Did that make him respect his mother? Did it accomplish anything? Didn't accomplish anything. But it taught him to argue against and fight against and prevail and get his way against his mother. It's a bad situation. Being a good parent doesn't mean you say no all the time. There need to be a lot of things that are yes. Mom, can we do this? Yes. Hey, can we go play that? Yes. Do you have time to do with this? Yes. There should be a lot of yeses and a lot of joy and a lot of fun. But if mom says no, let it be no. What did Jesus say in Matthew chapter 5? Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. Let your no be no. And this is an important foundation because they are learning to submit to an earthly father, and it prepares them for submission to a far more important father later. Have you seen children who try to manipulate their parents? They don't respect their parents? No. They try to argue about it, and I'd never do this. I've seen parents talk about, oh, you're so smart. He should be a lawyer. Don't do that. Don't encourage that. When if he likes to argue, if they're just trying to find some way to get around what mom and dad said, to find some way to argue against it, or to find some way that they should be the exception. You ever seen kids like that? Well, those kids grow up. Have you ever seen people in the church always trying to get around what God said? Always trying to make an exception? Always trying to justify themselves? We're not doing our children a favor. We are not doing our children a favor when we let them get the idea that they should get to do whatever they want to do. Now, there are times for finding out what a child would prefer and letting them do that. But don't let that become an entitlement where they can start throwing their weight around and get the idea that they get to decide everything that's going to be. Because real life doesn't work that way, does it? And if they decide, if they think they can only be happy when they get their way, what kind of marriage are they going to have? What kind of employee are they going to be? What kind of neighbor are they going to be? That's not doing a child a favor. So, if you want to get a good harvest, you got to spend time on it. If you don't do much, you can get weeds instead. It's going to be our choice. We want to avoid having an upside-down home. If you're looking for a house and a realtor takes you out, and says, I want to show you this house. It's got hardwood floors. It's got, you know, a new granite countertop. You say, oh, I'd like to see it. They say, all right, here it is. You'd say, yeah, I want to go inside and take a look. But if they pull up and there it is, do you even want to go inside? Anybody interested in that house? They just redid the bathrooms. It's really nice. Do you care? No! Why? It's got nice features in it. No, you're not interested in that house at all because it's got one big problem. It's upside down. Now, I want to tell you why. I don't know of any upside down houses around here, but this country is full of upside down homes. This, I think I got it from Michael Pearl, who's written some books about children, and I may have adapted it some, but assume if there's something well-worded, it was probably from his book, and if there's something not, you can blame it on me. But it makes this point. Too many children view the home, the parents, the food, etc., as merely a means to an end, to satisfy and please the child. The child makes his demands and manipulates the parents via tantrums and repeated misbehavior. Parents bow to the will of the child in efforts to placate and appease his whims and dissatisfactions, or suffer through increased strife and conflicts, which when they cannot. This home is like a house built upside down. And so the child views it as, I get what I want. And they're the parents, and they're to give me what I want. And so God's not really being concerned here. And what that child needs to understand, that's not the way it works. It's going to be what God says. That's what's important. And then after that, it's what the father and the mother say. And child's down here at the bottom of the totem pole. And he's loved. And he's enjoyed. And he should know that mom and dad are there for him and they love him. And home should be a secure and joyous place for him or her to grow up in. But he's not the boss. Why do children throw tantrums? To manipulate their parents. Don't be manipulated. Don't let them do it. And I'll tell you a story about my oldest granddaughter. Her name's Layla. And if you were to meet her, She is such a sweet, mature, just lovely young lady. You'd be very impressed with her. But when she was baby, she was a little bit of a pill. And my daughter knew to not let her say no. And so she didn't get to say no, but they'd gotten into things. I'll describe it to you in a minute because she told me about it later, but this is kind of how it went. They lived in Kentucky. They came up to visit us. And I would go to hold my granddaughter, and she didn't want to go to granddad. Okay. And I'm not saying I have the most baby-friendly face or anything else, but, you know, I'd reach out to hold her, and she'd go. And so I let that go for a few days. I'd try again. And after a few days, it's about the last day, and I'm not going to get to see her again. So I said, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to hold my granddaughter. And so I said, hey, you want to come to granddad's? She goes, And I just went ahead and took her. Oh, she pitched a fit. You know, she was like, she was just letting it be known how upset she was. And I just walked with her into the bathroom, and we looked in the mirror. I said, look at that face you're making. You know, and I'm doing it along with her, and that kind of took the thunder out of it for her. And she kind of calmed down some, and then I held her. And then what my daughter told me later, they said, they realized they'd been kind of placating her. They said, we wouldn't let her say no, but we'd set things up so that she could not have to be told no as much. And but she was just getting her way all the time. And you know what? Always getting her way wasn't making her a happy kid. So they decided she's going to stop getting her way all the time. And they got in the car and they started heading to Kentucky. They got to Wendy's. They got some food. And then she was supposed to say thank you or something, you know, to mom and dad. Whatever it was. Oh, she didn't want to do it. So they sat there and went over it and went over it. They spent 45 minutes sitting there. Finally, her will broke and she did what she was supposed to do. They got down to Kentucky and my daughter started doing some exercises with her. And she would have to sit still. She'd have her, she'd put the toys all in a circle all around her. And then sit here and she couldn't get to her toys until she sat still and listened to a book being read. Said, after you've listened politely, you can go play with your toys. There's all those toys. Now, she can go do that, which helped train her to sit still in church. Just a few weeks later, my daughter's cousin visited, and she'd been around my granddaughter a few weeks before and had seen kind of a fussy, unhappy baby. After this training that they put in, where they stopped giving her way all the time, guess what happened? Her cousin visited and said, what a sweet baby that was. You know, she was just so much happier because she wasn't getting her way all the time. Don't let that child get the idea of throwing their weight around of no or refutal or correction or demanding their way. That's not going to make them happy. It's going to make them spoiled. Here's how it works. As we said, God's first. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The husband is the head of the head of the house. The wife is to be honored. She's also rules the house here. And the children are to obey the parents. So that's really what we're looking at here. The rod and reproof bring wisdom. But a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. I'll tell you a story that I heard it up in Birmingham when I was doing this series, and somebody said, oh, let me tell you this story. So I incorporated it into these lessons, and I thought it was one of those apocryphal tales that didn't really happen. And then I was in Tennessee, and I told the story, and I said, now, I don't think this really happened. And turns out Sister Bunting was in the audience. And she said, it did happen, and my husband saw it happen. So I think it was Bob Bunting that actually saw this happen back in probably the late 50s. He was here in Florida in a meeting. She gave me the more details, so I know a little bit more about it now. I might get something wrong, but you'll get the gist of it. And he's staying with his family. They had a beautiful home. Interior decorators had paid, you know, done it all up really nice. But all those expensive drapes, none of them were hanging straight on the windows. They'd all been pulled down by the little Tyrannosaurus toddler. And it's breakfast time. And the baby's in the little high chair. And the parent has made, I think, some eggs in the skillet. Tries to feed it to this little one. I don't want it. And the parent says, what do you want? I want a worm. The adult went outside and dug around until they found a worm. They brought it inside. This little brat goes, I want it cooked. They put the worm in the skillet. They cooked it. They brought over the child. Child wanted it cut in half, and you eat half of it. The adult cut the worm in half, ate half of the worm. And now the child is happy, right? No, that's right. No. Do you think the child ate their half of the worm? One of the ridiculous parts of that story is that these people are supposed to be the adults. What foolish, foolish people. Here's a little bitty person controlling that house and needing something, and the parents aren't doing the job. I'll tell you this other one real quick if I've got time. I'll hold that one till tomorrow. Let's hit this first chart on this, and then we'll wind up for them tonight. Common mistakes to avoid. And we're going to go over a number of these over the next few nights. Mistake number one, and that's the only one we're going to do tonight, and then we'll start again tomorrow. Mistake number one is failing to discipline. And a lot of people do this. Proverbs 13:24 said, he who spares his rod hates his son. He who loves him disciplines him diligently. Now, please notice, what's the motivation for discipline? Love. It's not he who is angry at his son disciplines him. It's what? He who loves him disciplines him diligently. There are people that abuse children. There are people that need to be in prison because of what they've done to their children. This is not abuse. We're talking about discipline for their own good that's motivated out of love. And to do it right, we have to do what? We have to be diligent. Proverbs 19:18, discipline your son while there is hope. Do not desire his death. Proverbs 19, verse 18. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will drive it far from him. Proverbs 22:15. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. Proverbs 23:13. He may make it sound that way. I know one family where the boy told the daughter, you know, haven't you figured it out? Cry really loud and the spanking will end quicker. Proverbs 23:13. Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof, and later we're going to talk about the importance of those two working together, bring wisdom. But a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. Proverbs 29:15, if she's getting her own way, if he's getting his own way and demanding his own way, and it's got to be their way, how is that going to prepare them to obey God? How's that going to prepare them to deal with society? How's that going to prepare them for their first job? How's it going to prepare them for marriage? We were talking about this the other day, and that there's people now who, when they get fired, their mama comes down and complains and wants the boss to give their boy his job back. And you can see what kind of lifestyle that came from, right? When he was in first grade and misbehaved, who defended him and argued against the teacher? You know, when in the neighborhood he stole something or broke, who denied he did it and stood up for him and got him out of trouble? And so all along, she's been treating him like the world revolves around him and not making him accountable. And now he's a grown man, and she's still trying to make it work that way. Is it going to work that way? Yeah, because mama may think that the world revolves around my son, but nobody else in the world is down with that philosophy, and it's not going to work. And so it's a foolish thing to get that thinking started in the first place. A child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. Correct your son. He'll give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Proverbs 29:17. We'll pick up after that tomorrow night. Thank you so much for your attention this evening. I appreciate it. And good to be with you tomorrow evening as we'll continue our study. If you're here this evening and you want to bring Christ your broken life, that's what we've done with our lives in our rebellion to God. And what we need to do is to submit. What we need to do is realize we do not get our best life by demanding on getting our own way. We need to submit to our Heavenly Father. If you need to do that this evening, won't you begin that and come forward as we stand and sing.